This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Happy Halloween, and thanks for tuning in this afternoon. On the program today, a seasonal celebration of American popular song. Our guests are Philip Furia and Michael Lasser. They are the co-authors of America's Songs, the stories behind the songs of Broadway, Hollywood, and Tin Pan Alley. In between the stories this afternoon, we'll listen to some music. Music like this tune from Finian's Rainbow. This is Old Devil Moon. Lyrics by Yip Harburg. Music by Burton Lane. Yip will get us started here.
You and your glance make this romance too hot to handle. Stars in the night blaze in their light, can't hold a candle to your razzle-dazzle. You got me flying high and wide on a magic carpet ride full of butterflies inside. Wanna cry, wanna croon, wanna laugh like a loon. It's that old devil moon in your eye.
You know, Mr. Mahoney, that old devil moon's in your eyes, too.
It is.
Oh, it takes two to make a valley legend. I look at you and glory be. Something in your eyes I see soon begins bewitching me. It's that old devil moon that you
Old Devil Moon. Lyricist Yip Harburg started off there. Then we heard Biff McGuire and Jeannie Carson. Listeners, I invite your phone calls for our guests this afternoon, Michael Lasser and Philip Furia. You can join us with your questions and comments about American popular music. Call us and tell us one of your favorite standards, and our guests will no doubt be able to tell you its story. Philip Furia chairs the Department of Creative Writing at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. He's the author of several books about music, including The Poets of Tin Pan Alley, as well as biographies of Irving Berlin, Ira Gershwin, and Johnny Mercer. Michael Lasser is the Peabody Award-winning host of the radio program Fascinatin' Rhythm, which has been on the air since 1980. You can hear Fascinatin' Rhythm on our companion station, WILL-FM, on Friday afternoons. It follows the 4 o'clock news. Michael and Philip's book, America's Songs, the stories behind the songs of Broadway, Hollywood, and Tin Pan Alley, is published by Routledge. 333-9455, the number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area if you'd like to join the conversation. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Welcome back, Michael.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Hey, Jeepers Creepers.
Jeepers Creepers yourself.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. I liked starting out that way. I thought we would have a nice time this afternoon and we have everybody's eyes smiling. Jeepers Creepers, and then we hear again, you know, in your eyes, Old Devil Moon.
Yeah, Jeepers Creepers was written by Johnny Mercer, the lyric, which we didn't hear, just the instrumental,
right,
and the music by Harry Warren. And it was for a Hollywood movie where Louis Armstrong sang the song to a cow. He played a farmer singing to his favorite cow. The movie was called Going Places. The song did very well. It was Mercer's first nomination for an Academy Award. It didn't win, but it got nominated. And he got the idea. He was on a movie set, and he heard Henry Fonda in his Midwestern twang say, "Jeepers Creepers." And Mercer thought it was a way of cursing, a polite way of cursing. Instead of saying Jesus Christ, he would say Jeepers Creepers. And he thought that would make a great idea for a song. And it's, you know, how many poems and songs have been written about the eyes of the woman you're in love with? But Mercer gives it a new twist with Jeepers Creepers. Where'd you get those peepers?
Okay, and who did we just hear from there? Let's let the audience in on who's who here.
Oh, that was Phil.
Okay. Oh, that was Phil Fury.
Yeah, hi, Phil.
And Michael.
And Finian's Rainbow. You know, Finian's Rainbow is one of those shows that probably ought to be revived, and you'd have to do some tinkering with the book because there are things about it that might grate on sensibilities today. But it's got a wonderful score by Burton Lane and Yip Harburg, including, obviously, that old Devil Moon. Harburg is one of those great lyricists that people don't know. That is, you go up to a bunch of people and you say, do you know what Yip Harburg wrote? And they get this kind of funny look, and then you say, you can start with Over the Rainbow and the score to Finian's Rainbow and Paper Moon, and then they start to look embarrassed because how could they not know the man who wrote these songs? His real name was Edgar Hochberg, and he changed it. He gave himself a professional name of E.Y. Harburg. He Americanized it, made it easier to say and spell. And in the course of writing the score, there was this melody, because songwriters never throw anything away. And Lane had this melody he didn't use. It was called This Is Where I Came In. He'd written it for Lena Horne to sing, but that movie never got made. And he wanted Harburg to put a new lyric to it, and Harburg didn't like it very much. He really didn't want to do it. So Lane went to composer Harold Arlen, with whom Harburg wrote a lot of songs, and he told him the problem, and Arlen took Lane's side in the dispute, professional dispute, not personal.
Mm-hmm.
And so poor Yip was outnumbered, and he had to go back and write a lyric that he didn't want to write, and he ended up with the most important ballad in the score, that old Devil Moon.
Yeah, and that was his last great standard.
Yeah, it was. It was.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Yip Harburg and Harold Arlen, let's play another tune. It's something we all know. I will say no more. Of course, Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead. That is one swinging version. That's Branford Marsalis.
Yeah, everyone knows The Wizard of Oz as a classic children's movie, but a lot of people don't realize that movie really set a new standard for songwriting, because there are sequences in it where you have nothing but singing for 10, 15 minutes at a time. It really is an attempt to do what you get in a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta, where a song gets passed between different characters, and it really helps define who the characters are. I mean, you think of If I Only Had a Brain, If I Only Had a Heart. And it actually advances the plot. Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, We're Off to See the Wizard. And songs had not been used that way in movies before. So it really is a... It set a standard that then was followed by other movies, particularly at MGM, which did Wizard of Oz. I was thinking, it was Michael was talking about the the kind of arbitration that Harold Arlen had to do to get Yip Harburg, the lyricist, to set words to Burton Lane's melody for Old Devil Moon. Harburg also didn't want to use the song Arlen gave him the melody for that became Over the Rainbow. Arlen played it for him. And Yip said, oh, my goodness, that's a song for Nelson Eddy, not for little Dorothy in Kansas to sing. And so they took it to another friend, Ira Gershwin. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning. They went to Ira Gershwin's house out in Hollywood. And Yip said, Ira, what do you think of this melody? I don't think it'll work. And Harburg sat down at the piano and, you know, as composers do, played it with great flourishes and, you know, resounding chords. And Ira said, Harold, just pick it up with one finger on the piano. And when Harburg heard it with just one finger, he said, oh, that's great. I can write a lyric to that. And that became Over the Rainbow.
Yeah.
And
but
it almost was lost.
On top of that, Wizard of Oz could have ended up being an entirely different movie. Jerome Kern was supposed to write the score, which would have given it a whole other melodic feel. It might have ended up as an operetta, who knows. But Louis B. Mayer, this is the real biggie, and I think maybe a lot of people know this, Louis B. Mayer had a thing about Shirley Temple. Can you imagine what would have happened if her curly ship had ended up playing Dorothy? Can you imagine the number of Americans who would have loved it for about 2 weeks and never gone? I'm immune to Shirley Temple's charms. when people say she's cute, I curl my lip and I say, yes, I know, that's what's wrong. But I'm a curmudgeon. I'm very old, so I can be a curmudgeon. But it was Arthur Freed, who was a songwriter, wrote Singin' in the Rain, among many other songs. He was a lyricist, who was the assistant producer. It was his first attempt at producing. And he convinced Louis B. Mayer not to use Shirley Temple and to use Judy Garland, even though she was 18 and had to be bound so that her breasts would not show while she was playing this little girl. And then, of course, Freed went on to become the greatest producer of movie musicals. And there was the Freed unit at MGM doing movies like Singin' in the Rain and American in Paris and The Bandwagon and The Pirate and so on. And so The Wizard of Oz that we know is in one significant way because of Arthur Freed, who didn't write a word for it.
Mm-hmm. Going in, like the first time out, do composers and lyricists, do they have a sense that they know which tune is going to catch on, which tune we're going to be humming on the way out of the theater?
I think they know which songs are good.
I think they're really guessing. Irving Berlin was one of the most insecure songwriters. He, when he got a new song, he would grab anybody, a maid in a hotel room, a stagehand, you know, in the wings of a theater, and it'd go right up to their face, and he would sing the song to them, and he would stare, and if they blinked, he would think, this is not going to be a hit.
Can I tell you a story about that one?
Sure.
He once called a theater. This was in the 50s, and somebody answered, and he said, let me speak to Dick. And he meant Richard Rodgers. It was Rodgers and Hammerstein were in rehearsal for one of their minor shows, something like Me and Juliet or something like that. And the voice said, I'm sorry, Mr. Rodgers has gone to lunch. Who's calling, please? And the voice said, this is Irving Berlin. Let me speak to Oscar. And, of course, the young man on the other end got all flustered. And he said, well, sir, I'm sorry, sir. Mr. Hammerstein's gone to lunch, too. And they went through Josh Logan and everybody else. And finally Berlin said, who's this? And the young man said, I'm Harold Prince. I'm the assistant stage manager. And Berlin said, you'll do. And he sang him a song. And said, what do you think? And the kid, who grew up to be Harold Prince, said, I like it, Mr. Berlin. And Berlin said, okay, I'll publish it, and hung up.
Wow.
The sad part of that story is I have absolutely no idea what the song was.
Well, he was so insecure when they were working on Annie, Get Your Gun. He wrote There's No Business Like Show Business. And he demonstrated it to Rodgers and Hammerstein and Josh Logan. And he looked in their eyes as he was singing it, and they just kind of stared at him. And he took that as a sign of disapproval. So without saying anything, he just set the song aside. And as they were nearing rehearsal time, they said, Irving, where is that show business song? And he said, no. I could tell you guys didn't like that. I don't know where it is. And they said, oh, my God, no, that's terrific. Find it. And they went back to his music office, and everyone looked everywhere for There's No Business Like Show Business, because he just had one sheet of it. And finally, the secretary found it under a telephone book.
Same thing happened with God Bless America, when his musical secretary, who was then Harry Ruby, who became an important composer, when Berlin had him play God Bless America, when he first wrote it back in 1917, Ruby said, geez, Irvy, another patriotic song, and that's one of the reasons Berlin put it away and didn't publish it. At least not until 1938.
I was going to say, of course it did get published.
Yeah, but it took over 20 years, and that's another whole story.
Yeah, the radio singer Kate Smith, she wanted, this was 1938, and it was right after the Munich Pact, where Hitler basically got a license to invade Czechoslovakia, and everyone could see World War II was coming. And Kate Smith just asked Irving Berlin, she said, do you have a great peace song, a peace song? And he racked his brain trying to think of one, and he remembered that old song he had back in World War I, God Bless America. And he took it out, and he just had to make one change. It was Stand Beside Her and Guide Her to the Right with a Light from Above. Well, the phrase to the right in 1918 didn't mean anything politically, but by 1938, right and left really were loaded political terms. So he changed it to Through the Night with a Light from Above. And that was all he did, and gave it to Kate Smith, and it became an instantaneous hit.
I'll tell you a wonderful story about that. You know how it's become the song we turn to in times of national travail. In 1944, at Santo Tomas Prison in Manila, it was a notorious Japanese prison. And in fact, it was filled with survivors of the of Bataan and Corregidor, including 70-some-odd army nurses. And it was liberated by American forces in 44. But nobody would come outside. They didn't know who all these people were. There were soldiers and guns and tanks, and they were scared to death. And finally, a GI stood up on a jeep, took off his helmet and waved it, and said, hiya, folks. People came pouring out, hugging and kissing and crying and yelling. And one voice at the back of the crowd started to sing God Bless America. And soon everybody was singing.
How did the two of you collect all these stories?
Oh, my God.
Many years of research, actually.
Vacuum cleaner? I don't
know. Michael, years ago, heard me on a radio show when my first book, The Poets of Tin Pan Alley, came out. And he says that was before the days of email.
Yeah,
it was. I don't think it was.
I still got
the email the next day.
I've got the carbon of a letter, Phil.
Oh, it was a letter, okay. And he said, I heard you on the radio. You told some good stories, but have you ever heard the story behind As Time Goes By? And he gave me this wonderful story. And I said, you know, I've not heard that one, but have you heard the story? And then I told him the story of the song. And this went on for years. And that was just what we knew. But when we came to write the book, we had a lot of important songs, and we had no stories for them. So we spent months and months combing through newspapers. I think we read every book in the New York Public Library Music Division, and interviewed some songwriters who were still around. And it was a lot of research to get those gems of stories.
And the wonderful thing about the research is that it was not conventional academic research. We were looking to tell stories, and one of the surprises for me, I don't know if it surprised Phil, is that I found stories I found nowhere else, and to this day, I wonder how they got there, in newspaper obituaries. Mm-hmm. Up from 1923, from 1944, there's no way to trace how they got to be there, how the anonymous obituary writer found them. But there they were, and sometimes in more than one newspaper. And these were wonderful stories. There was a George Mayer, I forget the name of the song, which song it was, but he was a Jewish songwriter who was, it was for me and my gal, Jewish songwriter marrying a Catholic girl. And so they went to see the rabbi, and he asked what this young woman's name and what her mother's name was. And it was right out of the Emerald Isle. And there were O'Shaughnessys and O'Reillys, and the rabbi blanched. And so they were married by a justice of the peace, but she loved that song so much, it was on her gravestone. They had a very happy marriage. Now, where do you find a story like that? Yeah. Minor songwriter who wrote a major song. It was in his newspaper obituary.
Yeah.
Take him where you find him, right?
Right. Boy. Well, hats off to... the obituary writers.
Absolutely.
Well, the songwriters would swap these stories among themselves about how different songs came about. I know I got to know Sammy Kahn, who wrote so many great songs for Frank Sinatra, My Kind of Town, and Time After Time. He once told me, he said, there is a story behind every song. And I don't know if it's every song, but there sure are great stories behind a lot of them.
Yeah. That's what we're talking about here today on the Afternoon Magazine, America's Songs. Our guests are Philip Furia and Michael Lasser. They are the authors of America's Songs, the stories behind the songs of Broadway, Hollywood, and Tin Pan Alley. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Give us a call, and you can join the discussion this afternoon. You know, thinking of Irving Berlin and the stories you just told about him and how, you know, a song can get tucked away, you wonder if there are songs tucked away somewhere.
Oh, great thought.
Thousands of them.
Yeah.
I mean, think about how many songs these people chose not to publish because they didn't come up to their standards. And when you hear those songs, you know, a song that was cut from a score, for example, usually you find that the songwriters were right. The song they cut wasn't as good as the one they ended up using. But down in the trunks, down in the back of the files, there have got to be songs that are worth hearing.
Well, one that comes to mind is a 1924 song called The Man I Love by George and Ira Gershwin. They wrote that in 1924, and it was supposed to go in a musical that starred Fred Astaire and his sister Adele. And the song was just too slow for the kind of rapid pace of this musical. And so they cut it. And a few years later, they put the same song, The Man I Love, into another musical, but the show never made it to Broadway. They put it in a third show, and it got cut again. So here's this great song, The Man I Love, cut from three different shows. And it would have died if a member of the British royal family, Lady Edwina Mountbatten, just heard George Gershwin play it at a party. And she liked it so much, she asked for the sheet music, which at that time wouldn't have even been published. It would have just been handwritten. He made a copy for her, and she took it back to London and had some British dance bands play it. The song took off in London. It crossed over to Paris, where it was picked up by other dance bands, became a big hit in Paris, and then finally came back to America. It was the only song the Gershwins wrote that became popular that didn't come from a movie or a stage musical. The Man I Love became their one freestanding pop hit. But that could have been a completely lost song.
Yeah.
You know, there's also a movie that was made right after the war that featured songs by the Gershwins. George had been dead for 8 years, but somehow Ira decided to put words to two of his unpublished melodies for a 20th Century Fox musical starring Betty Grable and Dick Hames. And they didn't become standards, but they're charming songs. The movie is about a turn-of-the-century typist, that is, a feminist. And this was the movie was made in the 40s. And so there's a song called Aren't You Kind of Glad We Did, which has a nice sexy turn to it. And I'm trying to remember the name of the second song.
Bay Polka?
No, it's the Charming Miss Pilgrim is the name of the movie. Let me see if I can get this.
Charming Miss Pilgrim.
The Shocking Miss Pilgrim.
The Shocking Miss Pilgrim.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because in the 19th century, most office jobs were held by men.
That's right.
And women started coming into the workforce around the end of the 19th century, and many of them came in as typists.
They were known as typewriters.
That's right. The women were. And, of course, in the movie, Betty Grable has to wear her hair up in a bun because you can't have long-haired women working at a typewriter. Their hair will get caught in the keys. So part of the shock was that she was wearing her hair up and she was a single woman. And even in the 40s, single women had to wear their hair up. Only married women wore their hair. Single women could wear their hair down. Only married women wore their hair up.
The song, by the way, you're right, Back Bay Polka was part of the score, but the song I was thinking of, because it became something of a hit for Hames, who was very big in those years, was For You, For Me, Forevermore.
Right.
That's the one. And that had been around for some years until Ira, at least the melody had been around, until Ira put words to it, and it was used in a movie.
You've got another book coming, then, I suppose. Songs
that I know of. Phil, do you know something
songs,
I don't know?
Songs we should know that might have been standards that are charming songs that we should listen to.
Well, you know, when we first started doing this book, we had a list, and we have about 300 songs in the book, and the list was 700. So we've got plenty more if somebody wants a second edition, second volume.
I would love a second edition.
That led to a moment of silence.
I'm not jumping on that one. This was a lot of work.
Yeah.
But it was fun. And,
it was great
these
fun.
These songs are so great. They are, you know, they're still around, and people like Willie Nelson, Linda Ronstadt, Carly Simon, and most recently Rod Stewart have been singing them.
Yep.
They're American standards. They're kind of what we have as our classical body of song.
Yeah.
So it's just part of everyone's heritage, and it's great to find out how they were written, how they came into being, what inspired them.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, so central a part of American culture.
Yeah. Well, we're going to hear, I think we'll hear a little Rod Stewart in a little bit here singing a lovely standard. And, you know, Gladys Knight has a new album out that is...
No, I didn't know that, really.
It's called Before Me. And it's a tribute. It's a tribute to the singers who came before her and the songs that they, you know, did so beautifully.
I'm not as sanguine, I think, as Phil about some of the recordings. I'm glad the songs are being sung. I'm glad the contemporary singers are finding them. But I often find, or at least I think, that the singers don't have much of a feel for what they're singing.
Yeah.
They're making sounds rather than engaging the emotionalism of the lyric, because they were raised in a world that didn't listen to lyrics, and they don't quite know how. Some of them manage to, but I find that a lot of them often don't.
Well, it's true. I was playing some songs for my students, and I played a Rod Stewart thinking they would connect to it. I think it was My Funny Valentine, and about halfway through I just said, no, I don't care if you can't relate to this. You have to hear Sinatra sing this song. It's just too great a song. And what Sinatra did that so many contemporary singers don't do is he really became the character in the lyric. You know, he acted out the song.
Yeah.
He didn't have as great a voice, say, as Vic Damone.
Oh,
but
great
he
voice.
Knew how to, as they say, read a lyric, how to interpret it, how to really mold himself into the person who is evoked by the lyric. And there's nobody did it better.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And when you talk to singers, because I wrote theater reviews for a long time, I would often interview people as well. And when I got to interview people like Rosemary Clooney and Barbara Cook and some of the wonderful singers, and I would ask them how they chose a song, they invariably said it was based on the lyric. Mm-hmm. Did they find the lyric true, and did they believe that they could convey the emotional truth of the lyric? Obviously, they weren't going to take something with a dreadful melody, but the lyric had to work. That was the way they decided, and I found that very reassuring.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've also got Frank Sinatra in the wings.
Oh, good.
And we'll probably do that, I think, next. I'm going to give my director that cue there. And in the meantime, though, let's go and talk with a listener.
Oh, good.
In from Normal on line 4. Hi.
Hi. I'm enjoying the show. I have a question. I have heard this story, and I kind of want to validate it. I can't remember where I heard it. In the movie Holiday Inn, you know, the Valentine song,
mm-hmm.
Be Careful, It's My Heart. Yeah, it's just a lovely song.
Yep.
And I heard that he thought that would be the big number, the big
yes.
hit.
Yes, that's correct. That was supposed to be the big number, and White Christmas was supposed to be the Christmas song.
Yeah.
Yeah, he took a real risk in writing Holiday Inn. He'd originally wanted to do that as a stage production. But he realized that if he wrote a song for each holiday, unfortunately he didn't write a Halloween song, he did a Thanksgiving song, that it would be very difficult for those songs to become popular because they were so tied to that particular holiday, except for the Valentine song, Be Careful, It's My Heart, because, yes, it's a Valentine song, but also it's a universal love song. And he thought that would be the one that transcended the movie and would become independently popular.
And then... When White Christmas was released, the song, it did okay, but what gave it a real push forward was the response of the soldiers and sailors and Marines on Guadalcanal. They were sending V letters home saying, send us that new Christmas song, because they had heard it on this brand new thing called Armed Forces Radio. And the Red Cross was making small wind-up phonographs available to the servicemen and recordings as well. And so parents and sweethearts were dutifully mailing, going to the store and buying the 78 RPM record and mailing it off to Guadalcanal. And so Men in Combat were instrumental in helping to establish Holiday Inn, because that's when it really took off.
Yeah, and of course they were stationed in the South Pacific, and there was no White Christmas there.
And it,
you know,
was
tremendously nostalgic for them.
Yeah, it was a dream of home. And when Berlin realized what he'd written, because he wrote a Christmas song, he said that he wanted, or he gave orders, in fact, that the verse to the song not be published and not be sung.
Yeah, it's about being in Beverly Hills, L.A. on Christmas Day and dreaming of a White Christmas. And he originally thought of the song as... the scene he imagined was a bunch of very, very sophisticated theater people sitting around a swimming pool in Beverly Hills on Christmas Day and, you know, chatting very urbanely and then realizing how much each of them missed that childhood world of Christmas. And underneath their urbane sophistication came this very, very melancholy, meditative Christmas song. And that's how he conceived it. And when he realized how universal it was in its appeal, he cut that verse about being sophisticated in Beverly Hills, L.A., and just go right into I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas, the chorus or the refrain.
And the childhood Christmas that he was recalling was his own. He was Jewish, of course, and didn't celebrate Christmas, but he lived right across the street as a child from an Irish family, and he would go across the street at Christmas to see their tree, and he loved it. And then when he became an adult, his second wife was Catholic, and so they had a Christmas tree in the house, and he always loved Christmas as a family holiday. And in 1938, he was in Hollywood and couldn't get home, and he was lonely. And that's when he also conceived of writing this song. And so it weaves itself in and out of Berlin's own life and his own experience and the his way of designing something to fit in show business, and at the same time what's happening in the larger world. It's quite an extraordinary confluence of various strains that come together in work by someone I think is, without question, our greatest songwriter.
Yeah. Who wrote "Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas"?
Have you? Who did
write? Oh, that's from the movie "Meet Me in St. Louis."
Martin and Blaine.
Martin and Blaine wrote that, and again, that's a great Christmas song.
And
in the movie, Judy Garland sings it to Margaret O'Brien. After Margaret O'Brien, as playing a child, after she hears the song, because she's so upset because her family is going to leave St. Louis. Because the father is a lawyer who's been moving.
He's a banker, Phil.
Going to New York. And the family doesn't want to leave St. Louis. And Judy Garland, to console Margaret O'Brien, sings this, kind of cynical Christmas song, "Have Yourself a Merry Little Party." You know, we say when we don't get invited to somebody else's party. So it's "Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas." And tries to console Margaret O'Brien. Margaret O'Brien rushes out of the house. And there's snowmen in the yard, and she just takes a club and begins pummeling them.
Decapitates them.
Yeah. So it's a...
When Garland heard the words, she told Martin and Blaine that they had to soften it. It was more cynical when they first wrote
that's
it.
Right.
She had been entertaining the troops, and she'd been to hospitals, and she'd seen some of the results of combat, and she said, "You've got to ease this. This is 1943. Mm-hmm. You've got to give me something I can sing." And they did, as even though it's still a very strong song, one of a number of very melancholy Christmas songs written during World War II. They did soften it somewhat, and she sang it beautifully, magnificently.
I remember hearing that song after September 11th. Sung by James Taylor, and it about wiped me out.
Oh yeah.
I can understand why. The Christmas songs, the best of them, do have that melancholy streak in them, just as the holiday does.
Hmm. Maybe you could talk a bit about the ways that musicians and singers and arrangers take a standard and put their own mark on it.
Well, Sinatra was notorious for that. So changing words, changing notes, and not always for the better.
That's right.
There's a great line in Cole Porter's song, "I Get a Kick Out of You," which goes, "Flying too high with some guy in the sky is my idea of nothing to do." All those wonderful little I rhymes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Sinatra does not fly with guys. He flies with, as he would say, broads or chicks. So he changed it, "Flying too high with some gal in the sky." So Cole Porter once said to him, "Mr. Sinatra, if you don't like my songs as I wrote them, please don't sing them."
Uh-huh.
It's unimaginable. We wouldn't be listening to Cole Porter today if Sinatra hadn't sung so many of them.
But
he did change a lot of lyrics, and as I said, usually not for the better.
That's right. And not only did he change them, but he would usually, just before he sang the song, praise the lyricist, name him, and think about how anonymous most lyricists are. So here is Frank Sinatra saying how wonderful the lyricist is and giving America his name. And then in the name of this banal hipster thing that he liked to play, changing the words. Frank, are you paying attention to yourself?
Yeah. Witchcraft is what he's up to.
Yeah, well,
appropriately for today.
Yeah, black magic.
Yeah.
Witchcraft is an interesting song. Gets written in an interesting way. Dorothy Fields, the great Dorothy Fields. I adore her songs. I just went blank. On the Sunny Side of the Street, I'm in the Mood for... I'm not I'm in the Mood for Love. That's not it.
Yeah, she wrote that.
Yeah, she did. Okay, yeah. And the I Can't Give You Anything But Love, Baby, that's the one I was trying to think of.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a middle-aged woman now, and she goes to a party in New York. And there's a young songwriter, quite a bit younger than she, that she meets that night, or maybe she's met him before, but they don't know each other. His name is Cy Coleman, who just died a year or so ago. And they get chatting, and he gets up his nerve, and he invites her to write with him. Am I talking about the right song?
No, you're telling a good story, so go ahead.
All right. Yeah. This is Carol Lee.
Witchcraft
I should be talking
Carol
about.
Lee, yeah. But
it's the other way around. I was talking about another song.
Go ahead, finish the story.
All right. And she says, thank God somebody finally asked.
Yeah.
And so she went and wrote. The story with Witchcraft is just the opposite. He and a younger songwriter named Carol Lee, who'd been working in advertising and wanted to become a lyricist, met. And they were chatting on the street, and she got up her nerve and asked if he'd like to write some songs with her. And he said, sure, and she said, when? And he said, how about now? So they wrote Witchcraft.
Yeah. Carolyn Lee is a wonderful, wonderful writer.
Yes,
and
she is.
She must have written about 100 songs that went nowhere, and then in 1953 she wrote Young at Heart, which Sinatra recorded and made an enormous hit, and then she began getting invitations to write for theatrical productions. But she wrote the song inspired by the fact that her father was dying of cancer, and she wrote Young at Heart with him in mind. So it's, again, one of those happy songs that has that melancholy story behind it.
Yeah,
she and Coleman did nothing but fight. He was a piano player, as you know, I'm sure, a very good jazz musician, and wanted to take time away from songwriting from time to time to perform. And he told her, look, anyone who performs as well as I do has to do it. And it wasn't mere egotism. It was a recognition that he had two careers. And she didn't want any part of it. She wanted them to write. And they fought a lot. It was very contentious. It was like a troublesome marriage that survives, but by the hair on his chinny chin chin, until it didn't. It finally just broke up, and she unfortunately died quite young. If she had lived, she'd have been a major lyricist. But you know, it's not only the quality of your work. There needs to be a critical mass, a body of work. And I think she falls short there, but certainly not in the quality of the writing. She's a wonderful lyricist.
Mm. Well, we have to wrap up here, so what do you say? We listen to Witchcraft, and it's Frank Sinatra. And Philip and Michael, thank you so much for talking with us. Take care. Happy Halloween.
You too.
Philip Furia and Michael Lasser are the authors of America's Songs, the stories behind the songs of Broadway, Hollywood, and Tin Pan Alley.